Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panellists include runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey there.
Two-time store champion and two-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Soon to be three.
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor, Jesse Marshall.
Hi there.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. We're going to start off the episode tonight with a few spoilers from The Source, which is the last data pack for the Lunar Cycle. Similar to our other card highlights, we've selected a few cards that we think are worth talking about from the cycle, and we're going to take it through. We're going to shoot it off with Errand Boy. Errand Boy is a Wayland Ice. It's Sentry, Res 4, Strength 1, Influence 1. It has three subroutines, and each of them read, the corp gains one credit or draws one card. Jesse, what do you think?
It's another ice that punishes face-checking, which is where the runner runs into ice just to force the corporation to res it without necessarily having the breakers that they need or any breakers at all. So when you res this, it's worth noting that this doesn't end the run, so it's not as good as something like Enigma or Data Pike that or Rototurret that punishes face-checking to varying degrees and of different types, and also ends the run. This just gives the corp some benefit and still lets the runner through. So in that sense, it's a little bit weaker, but the fact that it has three different subroutines can possibly gain the corp three credits is pretty good. Each time the runner runs through, if you jam this on a central server, it's as taxing or more taxing than something like Caduceus, which people often use for that purpose. So yeah, it's pretty decent.
The next card is IT Department. It's an HB asset. Res 2, Trash 4, Influence 1. Click, place one power counter on IT Department. Hosted power counter. Choose a resed piece of ice. That ice has plus one strength until the end of the turn for each power counter, including the one spent, on IT Department. Shilzy.
Yeah, I quite like this. Not because necessarily of the comparison with Corporate Troubleshooter. I quite like this because if you can get it down, res it, and then click twice to power it up and protect it for that turn. Coming into turns two or into turn three gradually, your counters on the IT Department actually generate a very severe income when you can remove a counter and give a piece of ice plus seven strength and then have the runner have to face that piece of ice. You're leveraging a massive economic advantage over them. So I really like the way it scales very hard.
Yeah, I think that everything beyond the second or third counter, like once you start getting up to three, four, five counters on this, the amount of investment that you've put in for that fourth or fifth counter is one click. And when you remove it, the amount of investment the runner has to put into their icebreaker to get through that becomes very significant. An extra four credits to pump their Corroder to get through your barrier, or an extra four credits to pump their whatever other ninja or something like that, whatever else they're playing, or an extra four data sucker counters to reduce something to within Mimic or your Grange. That's really, really significant. So yeah, this definitely scales well, and once you get beyond three or four, it starts to get really dangerous for the runner.
The next card is Shoot the Moon. It's an NBN operation. It's a double. Cost 3, influence 2. As an additional cost to play this operation, spend a click. Res 1 piece of ice for each tag the runner has, ignoring all costs. I can definitely see this card going into a making news mid-seasons build. That said, you don't really need to have the mid-seasons who have gone off to like 5 tags to make this card worth playing. Even if the runner has only 1 or even 2 tags, this card becomes an economic card, and particularly in those Glacier decks, can be quite a good economic swing. Shilzy, what do you think of this card?
No, I agree with you there. Yeah, so I've actually been kind of moving away from mid-seasons lately. I feel like the windows in which you can use it are getting very, very small, especially as you start putting 5/3s into your deck. A problem I've had with the tag strategies of NBN for quite a while is that there's really very few ways to genuinely punish the runner for carrying too many tags without splashing for Scorched or without playing multiple closed accounts. They clog up your hand, just as the psychographics clog up your hand, and you can't get rid of those cards at all. They just sit there until you get legworked and you lose. But something like this, Shoot the Moon, that lets you turn tags into a genuine lurch in economy, it's going to be quite a good card, and I'm looking forward to testing with it quite a lot.
The next card is Virgo. It's an NBN Ice, Sentry, Res 4, Strength 5, Influence 2. Its one subroutine reads, Trace 2, If successful, give the runner one tag. If your trace strength is 5 or greater, give the runner one tag. Obviously, I think this again fits very nicely into a making news build, seeing as it's going to use your two recoding credits and another credit, so basically a total of a res cost of 5 to give the runner two tags if this subroutine cannot be broken. Wilfie, can you see yourself playing this card?
Yeah, I think it would go, as you said, really well into a making news deck. The ability to give your opponent multiple tags in one run is really good, and you only have to pay after you res it one credit if you use the recurring credits that you get each turn. So you spend 4 to res it has 5 strength, so it's unlikely that they're going to be able to break it, and it forces them to spend lots of money and still take a tag or take 2 tags, which I think is a really big swing and discourages them. Like for Errand Boy, it discourages the runner from face checking your ice. Being able to give 2 tags in one action is really powerful, because even if they run with their third click, they're forced to spend 4 to deal with the second tag and still are left with a tag. So I think against in that making new style where you have those recurring credits available to spend on this ability, it could be really powerful.
The next card we're going to talk about is Utopia Fragment. It's a neutral agenda. It's a 5 advancement for 3 points. As an additional cost to steal an agenda, the runner must pay 2 credits for each advancement token on that agenda. Limit 1 per deck. Now, while this is a 5 for 3 that doesn't protect itself like some other cards, it does have the ability that once you score it to protect your other cards. Jesse, what do you think of this one?
Yeah, the fact that this helps you to score the rest of your agendas is definitely a benefit. It's something that we talked about last week that's really good about Nisei Mark 2, even though it's a 4 for 2 that doesn't protect itself. The fact that it helps you to score out the rest of your agendas means that it's a really valuable player in your deck. Again, with all the cards that are limit 1 per deck, they're not particularly consistent. You can't guarantee that you're going to draw it as your first agenda. You can't guarantee you're going to be able to score it early game, so that definitely holds it back. But in a deck that's got to play some 5 for 3s or that wants to play some 5 for 3s, this is going to be leading the race in a lot of ways. This is going to be the first 5 for 3 that those decks are going to turn to, because if you do manage to score it out early, it turns your other 5 for 3s into NAPD contracts in terms of the way they protect themselves, so that's quite good.
The next corp card we're going to speak about is Marcus 1.0. It's an ice, barrier, bioroid, res 4, strength 3, influence 1. It's obviously from Haas Bioroid. The runner may spend a click to break any subroutine on Marcus 1.0. The first subroutine reads, the runner trashes one of his or her installed cards. The second subroutine reads, end the run.
Yeah, there's a comparison between this and Eli to be made. They both have 2 subroutines, they're both barriers. Unfortunately for Marcus, the res cost and the strength are reversed. So Eli is 3 to res 4 strength. This is 4 to res 3 strength. So it's a little bit worse there. Also, I'm not convinced that the runner trashing one of his or her installed cards is necessarily better than having another end the run subroutine. It is quite powerful. Runners don't necessarily have a proliferation of cards that are spare in play. A lot of runners run quite light these days. So even though the runner gets to choose, it can still be quite a big deal for them to lose an installed card. So in that sense, it does punish face checking a bit harder than Eli. So it definitely has some use. But yeah, the fact that it's a little bit more inefficient might mean it doesn't see as much play as Eli has.
The last corp card we're going to talk about today is Self-Destruct. It's a neutral upgrade with res cost 2, trash cost 0, and influence cost of 0. It has install only in a remote server. You can trash Self-Destruct to trash all cards installed in or protecting the server, and trace X. If successful, do 3 net damage. X is the number of cards trashed. Use this ability only during a run on this server. Shieldsy.
I really like Self-Destruct a lot. You kind of set it up in such a way that you, in the early game, you throw down the piece of ice that they can't necessarily break, you put your 3-2 agenda behind it, and you slap a Self-Destruct to it, and if they happen to, you know, play the Crypsis and charge it, or find the Yogg.0 and access through the quandary to get your 3-2, you just flip the Self-Destruct, you press that big red button, you throw it all away. You deal them 3 net damage in the process, and then you say, look, you can go into Archives and try and grab it, or you can recover from that 3 net damage and not die next turn to whatever I'm packing.
Very good. Moving on to the first runner card from this pack that we'd like to talk about, and we have Code Siphon. It's a Shaper event, cost 0, influence 4. It reads, make a run on R&D. If successful, instead of accessing cards, you may search your stack for a program and install it, lowering the install cost by 3 for each piece of ice protecting R&D, and then take one tag. Shuffle your stack. Wilfie, what's your opinion on this one?
Any tutor, as I've said before, deserves a mention just by itself because of its ability to quickly and efficiently find the cards you want from your deck when you aren't necessarily going to have access to them every game. So CodeSiphon is one in the long line of Shaper program tutors. So what differentiates CodeSiphon from its predecessors is that you have the potential to get the program for free. Say if the R&D is undefended, then you only have to pay the cost of the program you get permanently, or if it's lightly defended and you manage to get through, you can get the program for only a minimal cost as well. So in decks where you're going to need to find something really early and really efficiently, then I think CodeSiphon might have a use. Like, I'm thinking maybe in the decks that are revolved around Magnum Opus, because often it's not enough to have self-modifying code and test run. They can be a little inefficient because of how expensive it is to get the Opus in the first place. Like, self-modifying code for Opus takes 7, and test run, you need to replay the Opus, so CodeSiphon could have a use there, but I'm a bit skeptical because it's not guaranteed in the same way that those other cards are. And taking a tag, while not a huge drawback, does mitigate its efficiency a little bit.
And the last card from the source that we're going to speak about is Earthrise Hotel. It's a neutral runner card. Resource, location, Ritzy. Install, 4. Influence is 0. Place 3 power counters on Earthrise Hotel when it is installed. When there are no power counters left on Earthrise Hotel, trash it. When your turn begins, draw 2 cards and remove 1 power counter from Earthrise Hotel. It's also worth mentioning that this card is unique, so you cannot have more than one copy in play at one time.
I actually quite like it. Not because I think it's particularly efficient or because it has a relatively strong ability, but I like the way it quite efficiently turns credits into cards. And outside of, obviously, while in Shaper, you have things like Diesel and Quality Time. In Criminal, you have Andromeda and you have security testing, and you can generate quite an exorbitant amount of credits without necessarily developing your rig very quickly, because the limiting factor there is cards. So when credits are efficient and cards are not, look to Earthrise Hotel. And I actually quite like the imagery there as well of Andromeda hanging out in the Earthrise Hotel in the Ritzy place. She kind of belongs there, so I think it's quite fitting.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting also that on with the numbers on this one, you're paying 4 to install it, plus the card itself, plus the click to install. So it's essentially 6 if you value a click and a credit and a card equally. As Liam was saying, the way that this is beneficial is that if you're getting credits more efficiently, every deck has access to, through things like Sure Gamble, ways to get more than one credit for every click. Those decks may not have access to ways to get more than one card for every click without spending influence, and this gives them a way to do that. It lets you turn those credits that you've got more efficiently than one per click into cards that you're then, by using those credits to do it, getting more efficiently than one per click, which you may not otherwise have a way to do.
Something which might not be immediately obvious is that it's not necessarily a drawback to get cards slowly, because it means that you don't have to discard. Like, something, while it might not give you cards as quickly as Quality Time, you're much more likely to be able to play the cards as you draw them and minimize the loss, like maximize the value you get from each card.
Very good. Moving into our second segment, we thought we'd talk about icebreakers. Similar to our segments on ice and agendas before it, we're just going to go through on how to assess an icebreaker, what makes it good, the advantages and disadvantages of each type, how to create a suite, and how to assess your suite. Liam, I know that when I started playing competitively, you were very good at explaining to me how to assess one icebreaker over another. What's your general game plan when you see a new icebreaker that's been released? How are you assessing it, and how do you decide whether or not it's good in a vacuum?
I guess the first thing to recognize is that no breaker ever exists in the vacuum. Because of the asymmetry of the game, it's very easy to fall into this trap where we compare runners to other runners, and we compare identities to identities of the same kind, breakers to other breakers. But really, what we need to compare is fractors to barriers. We need to compare decoders to code gates, and we need to compare killers to sentries to evaluate how their efficiency occurs. So, but in my mind, the first place I always start is with the four major types, with code gates, barriers, sentries, and then the fourth is kind of a little bit different. It's a Lothar's Field in particular. I don't like to play a deck that can't run through a Lothar's Field just because it can't be yogged. So that's normally where I try and start. Think about the ice that you're likely to come across in each faction. Think about things like Elite. Think about things like Rototyrant. If you're looking at a killer, does it have zero strength? Does it have an efficient way to pump itself up? What sentries do you want to see? You're going to see Rototyrant at one end of the spectrum, and you're going to see Archer at the other end of the spectrum. So having a reference point on how a killer scales is a good way to evaluate it. So, for example, Pipeline is great against Rototyrant because Pipeline has one strength and Rotha has zero. So Pipeline never needs to be pumped to approach a Rototyrant. But if you're going to take a Pipeline and try and approach an Archer, Archer has 6 strength. So you're going to need to pump Pipeline 5 times, which takes 10 credits. Now, that's just not comparable to, say, using Mimic and Data Sucker. That's where you can compare icebreakers. You can compare icebreakers around a pivot that is a piece of ice that you actually want to deal with.
Yeah, so I think if you look at icebreakers of each type, each faction gets different efficiencies in each type of icebreaker. So Shapers are generally going to have efficient decoders. You've got Gordian Blade, which is very efficient. You've got Zoo Keymaster, which is a very efficient code gate breaker decoder at the bottom end of the scale. But Shaper doesn't have efficient fractors, and Shaper doesn't have particularly efficient killers either. Krim gets the efficient killers, and Anarch gets the efficient fractors. So each faction has really 2 weaknesses that they're having to plug from the other factions, or they have options within their faction that are slightly inferior. So when you're designing your deck, look at what your weaknesses are. You think, how much influence can I really bear to spend on icebreakers, bringing it in from the other 2 factions to plug those weaknesses? And is spending that influence on the icebreakers more efficient than spending the influence on economy cards or something else that's going to help me more? Essentially, you've got to determine what is the gap between the efficiency, if I'm a Shaper, between the efficiency of playing Corroda over Battering Ram, say. Is that 2 influence worth it? And at the moment, the answer is yes, because the Battering Ram is probably the next most efficient fractor. Maybe Inti, I guess you could say as well. Inti or Battering Ram. And Corroda is enough better than them that you're willing to spend the 2 influence on it at the moment, because it's just so much more efficient in being able to pump itself in terms of its play cost and in terms of the cost to break.
And that's even though the opportunity cost is a legwork. You're missing out on the legwork, 2 player Corroda, right?
Yep, so legwork, a Parasite, any of the other powerful 2 influence cards you're missing out on just to play that Corroda because it's more efficient.
Lastly, do we think there's any hard and fast rule in terms of the ratio of breaker types you should include in your deck, or is that really dependent on the metagame?
No, I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. Like, I'd say that the only consideration is being worried about losing a barrier breaker, say, to errant damage or to program destruction and needing to find another one. Like, once you have a barrier breaker, you can break any barrier at differing levels of efficiency, but still any barrier nonetheless. So it's not usually more efficient to, say, get a bigger breaker to deal with big barriers and a smaller fractor to deal with small barriers. So I wouldn't say there's a hard and fast rule. I'm happy just to play one, say, fractor or one decoder if I have ways to recur it, and if I don't, then maybe I'll play 2 or 3 just in case I lose one of them to damage or program destruction.
Generally, it is really important to have a good, efficient breaker for each of the ice types. Then you can play some AI breakers as well to make it more efficient. But if you're going all in on something like Overmind or Atman, it can really come unstuck. It can really come unstuck quite easily. So yeah, it's important to be able to get through all the ice, and it's important to have a good spread of the breakers, and program recursion and program tutoring or searching your deck for the right program is a really good way to make sure that you've got the programs you need at the time you need them.
Lastly, we're just going to move into a deck tech on Blue Sun. As we've mentioned before, Jesse was testing Blue Sun quite a bit before he went to Worlds, as we mentioned in Episode 7. He didn't end up going with it, but as far as I can tell, he still really likes the deck, and you've been testing quite a few different variations of the deck, Jesse. So how's that been going?
It's been going really well. I really like the identity. I think it's got a hell of a lot of flexibility in the way that it plays the game. You can invest credits in your ice, and unless they get destroyed, which can be a bit of a blowout, but is always a blowout whatever identity you're playing, as long as it doesn't get destroyed, you can use it as a bank that you can draw on at the beginning of any of your turns to fund things that you need to do. That means that you can get up to a lethal Seesaw Scorched a lot easier. It means that you can get up to 10 for restructure very easily, and it also means that you can reposition your ice, which is something that hasn't really been easy for Corpse to do up till now, and having the freedom to be able to do that in Blue Sun really unlocks a whole lot of new ways to play the game.
Without needing the line, you mean?
Oh, without needing the ever-present Tenma line, which has been a monster of our metagame for... No, I'm not even going to joke about that. So, what cards have I been playing in the deck? The particular variation that I'm working on at the moment is a Grail Ice suite. I see a lot of synergy between Blue Sun and Grail Ice. Firstly, when I saw the Grail Ice spoiled, I thought they're going to be at home in Wayland, because Wayland wants to splash for ice because it doesn't have particularly good ice outside of a few notable pieces like Archer and Ice Wall, I guess, at the bottom end of the scale. Because you're wanting to splash for ice, if you can leverage the maximum power out of the Grail Ice suite, which does come from playing all of them, then you can use that to your advantage. Blue Sun allows you to do that even more efficiently because you can return the pieces that you have in play when you need to, you can reposition them, and you can try and psych out the runner, because effectively the subroutines that are on each of the Grail Ice are effective whether they're in play or in your hand. As long as you have one of the three of them in play, they're a lot more versatile and a lot more difficult for the runner to deal with, because if you res one, say you res a Galahad in the early game and you had a Merlin and a Lancelot in your hand, you might be able to get them firstly with the Merlin, which is fantastic. Then you can bounce the Galahad and play one of the other two after they've played their Corroder, and you're demanding that they get another breaker, otherwise you're going to kill their Corroder with the Lancelot and they're going to take damage and you're still going to be able to end the run. So you can cycle through the three effects really well and demand all three icebreakers, which is a pretty powerful thing to be able to do. So how does the deck leverage that power? I've gone through various different builds. Some of them got a little bit too dirtily on the assets. Blue Sun obviously also has the ability to leverage things like Adonis Campaign and get more out of them by making them infinite, by being able to bounce it after it gets to the end of the campaign, or just bouncing it the turn you res it and using it as a click to gain 3 credits, because all you've done is invest the click to install it, and as long as they don't trash it before your turn comes around, you can res it, paying 4 to res, gain your 3 at the start of your turn, and then get the 4 back by bouncing it to your hand, so you're effectively gaining 3 for 1 click. So I was trying all of those things. I tried Executive Boot Camp from the upcoming pack, All That Remains, and that was a neat card. It lets you res ice at the beginning of your turn for 1 discount, which may actually come back into the deck when Valencia Estevez comes out, because being able to res ice proactively at the start of your turn gets around blackmail, which is a pretty sweet little interaction. But in general, I found Executive Boot Camp wasn't quite cutting it. That 1 credit discount and being able to res at the start of your turn is not really something you always want to do, and it's definitely not something you want to be doing when you're trying to bluff out your Grail Ice. So there's a bit of anti-synergy there, though being able to tutor for Jackson Howard was handy. So Executive Boot Camp has come out recently, and I've sort of focused the deck more around trying to create all early scoring windows using the power of the Grail Ice and the multiple subroutines to try and get out an Atlas, a Government Contracts, or an NAPD contract, and then using the threat of Scorched Earth in the mid game through your powerful operation economy and your ability to return your mid range ice to your hand, using that threat of Scorched Earth to try and either create more scoring windows or kill the runner if they try and get too aggressive on you. So the deck's really found a nice mid-rangey place. I feel like it's at a really good spot at the moment. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you all think about it. We'll post the deck list with the episode as usual. I'll run through a few of the notable ice. Merlin has been performing a lot better than I expected. I guess the other guys who I've been testing against, particularly against Liam and Wilfie, how have you guys found Merlin from the runner side when I've been...
The first time I discovered Merlin was in the deck. I took 6 damage from it. But the Grail Eyes in general has been quite threatening, particularly the mode in which a runner will find a mimic or find a fairy and then begin to run, protecting their Kurotha or protecting their Yogg. It doesn't work against Grails, because you could just as easily see a Galahad and Lancelot could be backing up Galahad, or you could just as easily see Merlin and a Yogg won't deal with Merlin without Darthasucker, and again Lancelot could be backing it up, and you will lose your breakers, you will lose your programs. It really demands a lot of finesse when face checking and trying to decide when the runs are safe.
I am playing archers. I've got 2 archers at the moment to go with the 3 hostile takeovers. It's possible that 3 archers might also be good. Archer is probably the best Wayland Ice hands down, and you can't really play a decent mid-range deck without it, which means you need to play hostile takeovers to turn it on, which means that your NMPD contracts are going to be a little bit worse because you've potentially got that bad pub floating around. So I have got veterans programs in there to allow you to deal with that a little bit. I know veterans program is not the best agenda in the game, but being able to remove 1 or 2 bad pub is a reasonable upside, not only for the economic side of things, but also because it turns your NAPDs back into 4 for 2s, which is pretty good. So the other ice, I've gone up to 2 Lotus Fields again, because Lotus Field not only is one of the best mid-range ice, but can completely lock some decks out if they're not coming well-equipped to deal with it, or if you can manage to snipe one of their important breakers. Hive is absolutely fantastic in Blue Sun. You can res it early. I'm playing 3 Hives. You can res it early. Once you've scored a couple of agendas, you can bounce it back to your hand and get the full 5 credits back. It's absolutely fantastic for creating those early scoring windows, and the number of subroutines that it has when you've got nothing scored really lets you force out that first Project Atlas or that first government contract, because it's very easy to be sure that they're not going to be able to get through it in the early game. So Hive is fantastic. The other ice, Caduceus, can be reasonably taxing and reasonably good to place on a central server early in the game, and being Blue Sun again, once you feel like it's redundant or once you've maybe got a bad pub and they've got a mimic, at which point it doesn't really tax them at all, you can return it to your hand and get the 3 credits back, which is really, really sweet. Then you've got Enigma, and then you go down to the sort of ice walls and quandaries at the bottom end of the scale, which are just there to help you protect your centrals in the early game. And again, being able to bounce your quandaries later on when they're not doing anything, potentially even redeploy them as inside job protection onto a remote, is just a great amount of flexibility that you get from Blue Sun.
Did you find any room for a Crisium Grid?
Yeah, so there's 2 Crisium Grids in there. I've been testing with Crisium Grids since the pack came out, and it's really phenomenal what it does, being able to help you against account Siphon, giving yourself a little bit more safety in the mid game against Siphon, and also being able to protect against Legwork at the same time, denying them some credits off their Desperado and some Datasucker counters, sometimes even just jamming one on Archives rather than having to worry about protecting it against security testing and Datasucker is just fantastic, and forcing them to spend that 5 if they want to turn that economy back on. So Crisium Grid's a really fantastic card.
Jesse, I think some of our listeners will be curious to know why you haven't chosen to play Oversight AI. I think a lot of people do consider that to be an auto-include in a Blue Sun deck. Can you tell us why you haven't done that?
Oversight AI really is a 2-card combo that you're going to be going for with Curtain Wall. Not only does that require you to have both of the cards for it to work, but it also requires you to be playing Curtain Wall in the first place in your deck, which is not something that I really want to be doing. Playing just Curtain Wall and Oversight AI is probably the way I would do it if I was going to do it at all. I don't think going in and trying to have more ice that work with Oversight AI, like Hadrian's Wall or something like that, is really the way to do it. I think decks that increase their average cost of their ice too much just to try and leverage a bit more economy off Oversight AI are not really doing it the right way. Yes, you can go for the blowout potential of playing 3 Oversight AI and 3 Curtain Wall, but there are some times when those cards are just going to be dead in your hand when you don't have the corresponding card in the combo, and I really like to avoid those sort of situations when I can. So I haven't gone with that. I've really pared this deck back, tried to make it mid-range, tried to make all of the ice a reasonable cost that you can res it as is, and I think it's working quite well. I really don't feel that beyond restructure, hedge fund, and hostile takeover, you really need a lot more economy. I feel like the economy functions quite well.
I also feel like, in general, with Oversight AI, it's a very strange card in the way this game works, because it doesn't really fit into any model of deck that we have a good basis for, or a good shell for. In an oversight AI deck, you want to res a gigantic piece of ice once and then score very quickly an agenda behind it. But you want to score a large agenda, which means you're probably not playing many agendas, you're probably playing 5/3s. So you need to draw cards very, very quickly to access this agenda in this 2-card combo before they get their rig out, but you also need to not die in the process. So it's kind of a weird position to be in, where you can't play the small ice you need to protect yourself in the early game while you assemble your combo, but you also can't be in the late game, because as soon as they do have their Corrode for the curtain wall and they do save up the cash, it's just gone. So I just don't see how a very well tailored curtain wall oversight AI deck exists either in the early game or in the late game. It doesn't belong in either of them, and so it's just a weird beast.
Well, I mean, with Blue Sun, you can get some early game out of your oversight AI, which is good. Like, if you play the curtain wall, oversight it, and they on turn two, say, and they can't get through it because they've spent most of their credits on turn one deploying a rig, like a lot of decks do, and then you get to bounce the curtain wall, you're up a lot of credits, and you can then potentially be in a position to res that curtain wall permanently without the condition counter on it, so that it's not going to die if they break it once. So that can be good. I'm not saying that it's terrible. Obviously, I think Timmy played Oversight AI and Curtain Wall in his Blue Sun deck that he took to thirds at Worlds. So the strategy is viable. It's just not something that I like to play. It's not something that I find to be particularly consistent. And I've gone with, as I said, a more mid-rangey, low to mid-range cost ice, but using the Grail ice and the multiple subroutines there to create really taxing servers in the early to mid game to allow you to force through some early agendas. That's what I've preferred to go with.
Sounds very good, and I'm sure our listeners will be keen to try out the decklist. As usual, the decklist will be available in our show notes. That's about all we have time for this week. If you'd like to get in contact us with questions, topics, or decklists, you can email us at thewinningagenda.com, tweet us at winningagenda, check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. Other than that, we'll be back next Monday as usual. And until then, see you guys.
Thanks.